Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Social scientists and medical professionals have been studying how violence affects childhood development for over 40 years. As we heard yesterday on Medical Monday Studio Tulsa, exposure to trauma in household or environmental violence during youth can cause profound physiological and neurological changes that manifest itself two or three generations down the road. A child who is a victim or witnesses domestic violence is 10 times more likely to commit violence as an adult. But beyond that, there are no set responses to trauma and violence. My guest today, Dr. Lawrence Aber, has studied the enormous variety of responses children exhibit when exposed to different levels and types of violence. And he is at the forefront of techniques that can mitigate traumatic stress responses. Aber is the Wilner Family Professor of Psychology and Public Policy at New York University and directs their Global Ties program that works with stressed children in the Congo, Sierra Leone, and Lebanon. His research examines the influence of poverty and violence at the family and community level on the social, emotional, behavior, and academic development of children and youths. He was a guest of OU Tulsa yesterday, and I spoke with him while he was here. Dr. Aber, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
We've been studying how violence affects childhood development for around four decades, maybe even a little longer. We've learned an awful lot, but what would you say the biggest piece of information we've learned over that four decades on how to make a positive impact on a child who's affected trauma or violence within their life?
That's a great question, Rich. And I actually have to begin with understanding how violence affects kids. So we have learned a lot over the last four decades in how violence gets under the skin of kids and into their head. And, you know, anybody in their right mind knows that violence isn't good for kids. But exactly what is it about violence? What types of violence? And how does that affect kids? What we've learned is that there are many types of violence. So there's violence between a parent and a child, which is, in a way, the most disturbing form of violence, child maltreatment, child abuse.
The most trusted figure in their life.
The most trusted figure and the figure who children rely on for a sense of security and safety. There's violence that isn't perpetrated on the child but happens in the family, children witnessing domestic violence. And that is very troubling as well. There's violence between peers. So children, since the Lord of the Flies and way beyond, can really be cruel to each other and actually violent toward each other. And then there's more distal forms of violence, ranging from living in very violent communities where you're exposed to violence and maybe collateral damage in that, to, in our world, intrastate and interstate conflict, civil wars and state wars. All these forms of violence have different effects in different ways, but they have common pathways. What violence does is makes children's immune system and stress response system in their body go haywire. So when we're in danger, we flood our body with cortisol that puts us in a position to fight or flee. Well, when that system is chronically aroused over and over, that creates wear and tear on your immune system, your inflammatory system, so that children are much more likely to get infectious diseases and physical ailments. But it also affects brains and brain development. And it has effects on what we're increasingly calling executive functions. How good is your short-term working memory? Like, you probably don't remember now how long my answer's been going. How flexibly can you deploy attention? How much can you inhibit a behavioral response that isn't appropriate? All those things are affected by violence. Hmm. And so that's how violence gets in under the skin and into kids' heads.
Now, when you're talking executive function, a lot of people think of the long maturing executive decisions that sort of bring on maturity, the frontal lobes.
It is a prefrontal cortex, frontal lobe location where executive functions develop. But actually before adolescence, a first big peak in the growth of the prefrontal cortex and in the growth of executive function is in early childhood. So many, many important things happen repeatedly in development. And the effects in early childhood can be especially long-lasting.
Yeah. When a child reaches his early 20s is when that sort of executive function really takes over. But if you haven't done the maturing at the early childhood level, then that child is at a disadvantage once they do reach maturity.
That's right.
And this, I think this gets into the thing where you hear a lot when you're talking about childhood development and being exposed to violence, is these life cycles where the actions of the parent affect the child becomes the parent, and these sort of same patterns of violence and trauma sort of repeat themselves generation after generation.
They do, but it's important for your listeners to understand that while there's a high probability of repetition, it's not determined. So about 3 or 4% of American parents would meet formal definitions of abusing their kids. About 30 or 40% of parents who are themselves abused abuse their kids. So knowing the single multi-generational point that a parent was him or herself abused increases by tenfold the risk from 3 or 4% to 30 or 40%. But there's still 60 or 70% who don't. So that's the darn part of using evidence and information to make these decisions. They're complex. But the 60 or 70% who don't hold part of the secret to how we can organize to help parents who have been mistreated themselves in their own life rise above that and treat their children well.
So I think the lay answer would be that they experience these conditions. By God, they're never going to do what they experienced to their children. And I'm sure it's not that simple, but is there something to that?
If human willpower were that strong, that just by virtue of having something happen to you and being determined not to repeat it, I wouldn't weigh 20 pounds more than I'm supposed to. So human willpower can be enhanced, but no, the things we're learning, there's a couple of things. One of the things we're learning is that actually people are born with different sensitivities to environments. You could think of some people as being like dandelions. They don't need a particular kind of environment. They'll grow almost anywhere. Other people as orchids. They're really only going to thrive under a certain kind of condition. So some dandelion kids are not going to be as damaged by the same violent history as some orchid kids. But if they get through it, the orchid kids are going to be beautiful and miraculous and that kind of stuff. A second thing we've learned is, and this is especially true in maltreatment, but it's true in general, what every child needs is one competent adult who's irrationally in love with them. So children who are abused as children and who break the cycle of abuse with their own children have had found somewhere a teacher, a coach, a pastor, an aunt, an uncle, a big brother, who can serve as that competent person who loves them beyond reason. That's one of the biggest protective factors in all that. But there are also other factors, too. Do you grow up in a neighborhood that condones violence as a way of resolving interpersonal conflicts? Do you grow up in a community where it's so hard to feed your family on a predictable basis that you're stressed out all the time? Those kinds of things that are actually beyond your control also can take the same parent and tilt them toward behavior that they'd prefer not to engage in versus tilt them toward breaking that cycle.
Mm. Now, earlier we were talking about the violence of a parent against a child. There's peer violence. Do we see different reactions to the trauma depending on, getting back to this topic that's your topic discussion, is there a normal trauma? Is there normal reactions within the range of the trauma or the violence that a child experiences?
Yes, there's a lot of variation in response. Part of the variation depends on the stage at which a child is abused or experiences violence. So an infant toddler experiences violence and they have a different reaction than a preschooler or a middle schooler or a high school kid. But a second part of it is that the meaning of the violent act is very, very important. There's been, for instance, a very big study on how disasters affect kids and distinguish three types of disasters: mass violence like mass shootings or 9/11, man-made disasters like Chernobyl, and natural disasters like hurricanes, typhoons, floods. All other things being equal, the more people see something caused by human intention.
A malevolent
human act, mm-hmm. where mass violence is greater than man-made disasters. But that was a malevolent act, too. People were neglectful versus an act of God. The more human intentionality there is, the harder it is for children to make meaning of this. Why is this happening? It must be something about me. Why are they after me? That kind of stuff. So the meaning, and that obviously changes with the age of the child. An infant actually reads meaning. Infants and toddlers read a lot of the meaning of things through the faces of their parents. When a child does something and a parent thinks it's great, the smile says, that means this is good. When they frown or they get angry, that means something's bad. So there's only a few channels that it comes into, but they're important channels in infancy. By the time kids are teenagers, they have an enormous ability to interpret the meaning of these things, and that's a big part of it.
Well, how important in intervening is age of when these traumas take place? Is it harder to intervene with, say, a toddler, or easier to intervene and make a difference and sort of break these trauma cycles?
You've gotten to know me well enough, Rich, now to expect my answer.
It's not easy.
It's both. It's both easier and harder to intervene at earlier ages. It's more necessary, but it's never too late. So one of the things that has been emphasized over the last 10 or 20 years is how important the early years are, and they are. But it's not over then. There are other periods of what scientists call plasticity, of malleability in basic human development. And after infancy and toddlerhood, the preschool years is a critical one, and then the middle school years. And then when all of the hormones flood and start reorganizing early adolescence brain, that's another period of time. So I would say that there are special opportunities to intervene to help put kids on the right trajectory at every stage in life. But it's a little harder when children begin to have patterns and momentum. It's harder to shift it later. It's not impossible, but it takes more effort and it takes more power. You can bend the twig to grow in a certain area earlier in development than you can bend it later in development.
We had a guest just the other day that was talking about the genetic predisposition towards trauma and how it can cycle through at least a generation, and what their findings may be two generations, like a direct trauma of a grandparent. At least this is in mice and in animal trials, show up two generations later as your genetic material is changed over that generation because of that trauma. Do you subscribe to that?
Yes, with caveats. So many people continue to think of genes as a simple determinant of behavior. There's nothing we've learned about genes that suggests that's how they work. You remember the old nature-nurture debate. It's not which one, nature or nurture. It's nature and nurture. So genes involve predispositions to act or express in a certain way. But those predispositions are expressed or not depending on exposure to experience. So said in another way, yes, genes can be the carriers of predispositions to acting in certain ways. But it's what are called epigenetic processes. It's actually what experience makes out of genes that is the cause of these multigenerational transmissions. And remember, if you can increase your understanding of the intergenerational transmission of trauma by a factor of 10, the very first thing we talked about, 3 or 4% of the general population, 30 to 40% of kids who are abused, you're finding a whopping risk factor for that. But they do not explain 100%. There are still 60 or 70% of the parents who escape that trap. So multigenerational transmission of trauma is not a life sentence.
Yeah. But what I was hearing was like the cortisol levels are sort of prone to fluctuate or stay low at a low level when they're experiencing trauma, as opposed to that sort of fight or flight mechanism that we expect.
That's right. There's a lot of things that the human body and the human psyche is a tremendously interconnected thing. And you tweak something over here and it's going to work its way through the system and come out over there in certain types of ways. And so the cortisol, the stress response system, is something that has helped us survive as a species. If we couldn't mobilize that boost in cortisol when the tiger was coming for us, we'd be it. And if we were eaten, we weren't going to pass on our genes. So when it's hyper-aroused and it isn't a tiger, then it has really damaging effects.
And of course, there's the other side of it. I think Robert Sapolsky's done a lot of work on this, is the idea that we were used to bursts of cortisol when it was a life-threatening situation. Now our lives are sort of this low level or medium level, or even
of chronic stress.
Yeah, chronic stress.
That's exactly.
And that also plays into the reaction for a childhood where you're in a neighborhood where you are constantly on high alert because you never know if somebody coming around a corner is going to be shooting a pistol.
And God bless them in other parts of the world, too. So over the last 5 or 6 years, I've been working increasingly in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, now in Niger, Sierra Leone, Lebanon. Children, refugee children who are refugees from war and who have experienced the kind of intra and interstate conflict and violence, and their families have. One of the things that, in a way, the scientific community has identified is the old wisdom of mindfulness and contemplative practices. So one of the things that we're learning, you can teach a child, a teenager, an adult, and even an old geezer like me, is to downregulate through mindfulness-based meditation and breathing practices. It's millennia old. And what we're learning is how those kinds of processes help reshape the stress response system in a way. So there are practices that are old, ancient, wise practices that scientific evidence is beginning to say, boy, there's something there. Let's build on that to protect kids.
I was going to ask about the Global Ties program, which is the one you were alluding to. My guest today is Dr. Lawrence Aber, the Wilner Family Professor of Psychology and Public Policy at New York University. He was a guest of OU Tulsa on the effects of trauma and violence on childhood development. You have been spending a lot of time with this Global Ties organization looking at the Congo, where you're probably looking at multiple generations of people who have been dealing with factional violence, lots of horrendous acts of violence. You're also looking at Syrian refugees, beginning a program with Syrian refugees.
Yep.
Can you maybe talk about what you're finding as far as how people react to being exposed to warfare on a sort of medium level for a long, long period of time?
What we're finding is that it both increases the probability of violence within families, but has a life of its own, too, and a life that makes things difficult. We've been working a lot with the International Rescue Committee, one of the world's leading humanitarian relief organizations. They got started after World War II, resettling refugees from the Great War against Hitler. And the International Rescue Committee has developed an approach to basic education called Learning in Healing Classrooms. And what they have begun to do is embed social-emotional learning principles into literacy and numeracy instruction so that you're educating the whole child, not just their head, but their heart and their body too. And in very rigorous experiments, field experiments in the Eastern Congo, we found that that has increased children's sense of how safe and supportive their schools and teachers are. So we were talking earlier about how that sense of safety and security from adults in your life is fundamental. If you're not finding it in home, if you're not finding it in the community, can you find it through schools in war-torn areas? And the answer is yes, you can. And that we're also finding that when kids feel more safe and secure, they're freer to pay attention to learn. So it increases. 1 year of being in learning and healing classrooms leads to a 4-month gain compared to kids who don't have it in reading and a 10-month gain in math. So it is possible to have really profound effects on kids' schooling outcomes and learning if you take care of the stress response system by creating safety and security. And we've been talking about a lot the physiological reactions of children to stress and trauma, but there are cognitive mental reactions too. We demonstrated a number of years ago that children who have experienced maltreatment are more vigilant to very subtle aggressive cues in their environments. They become hyper vigilant to little things like whether a picture of a knife is shown. And that hypervigilance does detract from the ability to pay attention to
other
things.
Let me throw out another example. Say a teacher in a large classroom has a moment, just a brief moment of frustration where maybe they jerk their hand up to the back of their neck or something like that. That child's going to interpret that as an aggressive move?
More probabilistically more inclined to do that, but not all the time.
Right.
And all those little probabilities add up to taking a child on a different path. Another really clear example is we've discovered that there's a tendency for children who've been exposed to violence and harsh treatment to develop what's called hostile attribution bias. And I can tell that story best through imagining two children in a school cafeteria, and one child spills milk on the other child. What is the attribution about the social intention of the child who spilt the milk on the child who got the milk spilled on? What happens within less than a second about the social meaning of that? Were they trying to hurt me? Was it an accident? Do I not know? And I have to seek more information. That attribution happens in less than a second. And when it happens, you're on a path. If they're hurting me, I'm fighting you. Mm-hmm. If it was an accident, no muss, no problem. If I don't know, I seek information. So hostile attribution bias, you can't change children's behavior without changing their minds. You can't change their minds without changing their behavior. These are very intertwined, and bringing these together in effective strategies is what we need to be doing.
One of the things I was in reading about the research you're doing is we're understanding trauma's effect on children, but has that information really filtered down to the teachers and adults that are the caregivers outside of the home or even within the home that interact with that child on a regular basis? Have we managed to get that filtering down?
No. And
I think that would be very frustrating.
I spent the morning at Oklahoma University Tulsa's Schusterman Center, their simulation center, where they are using simulation exercises to help medical students, nursing students, and social workers learn how to work with patients before they have to go out and do this. And the Haruf USA group is doing that with professionals who work with maltreated children. From the policeman who responds as the first responder at the door to the social worker to the physician, all the way along. In the medical profession, there is tremendous experience-based learning where you're taking science down and informing the kernels of everyday practice. In education and in mental health, that's a much, much harder connection to make. We just haven't done it yet. The science is growing as fast as the basic science in the biological or medical sciences. The application of the science, the translation of it into effective practice, has been slower. And we could spend an entire show talking about that. I'm frustrated, but I'm not pessimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic that as we know more and as the cost of not acting more intelligently grows, we will be led to doing better.
Are there pretty simple techniques that could be implemented in a classroom that can make a difference? Because, you know, you think of teachers. Teachers are doing all sorts of things, you know, in that classroom. And this is just another
Absolutely.
Essential part of their job that they probably
Absolutely.
Feel ill-equipped to take on.
Yes, and there's a couple of secrets to that. The first thing is if it already happened, it's too late. So the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure idea. You want to manage classrooms in a way that reduce stress and through the natural processes help children and teachers deal with their stress way earlier in the cycle. So there are simple yoga exercises and breathing exercises that teachers are now doing with kids. You do that between classes instead of let kids hit each other between classes, and it turns out that they learn better. There's another former student of mine who is a brilliant young woman at Harvard University named Stephanie Jones, has developed a series of games called brain games. And they are things that you can do in a couple of minutes, again, between classes that help promote executive function, that help promote working memory, that help promote flexibility of attention deployment. But the secret is they have to be short, fun for the kids and fun for the teacher.
Yeah. Well, earlier you were talking about the intervening things like the intense love from somebody in their life, whether it's a family member, or extended family member, peer, or you know, teacher or coach.
Right.
You talked about this meditation and mindfulness. What are some of the other sort of easily accomplished interventions.
Another one is learning how to use high-quality children's literature to not only teach reading, but to teach social-emotional skills. So you read a story, and the stories that compel kids are the stories that compel everybody around the world over. You know, so-and-so used to be my friend. They're not anymore because I got in a fight with them. So-and-so lied to me. How do we become friends again? Those kinds of things. If you use that kind of literature, and then you help children become more articulate in how each character is feeling and imagine themselves in those roles, you can actually change hostile attribution bias. So, you know, by simply asking questions, how do you think Rich was feeling when you spilt the milk on him? What do you think Rich thought? How could you help clarify, help Rich understand that it was an accident? Those kinds of things are relatively simple. They're easily scripted. They're questions that kids seek and are interested in. And they've been shown by rigorous field experiments to reduce hostile attribution bias, the tendency to see a hostile act when it isn't there, and reduce aggressive behavior.
Taking that in the abstract can help inform their own behavior when an incident happens
that could set them off. We see transfer of those skills and perspectives from the learning situation to the behavior situation in the classroom.
Well, you're going to be speaking about, is there a normal trauma? And it sounds like there is no normal trauma.
The reason I say that and titled the talk the way I did is because a lot of people think of trauma as a discrete single event. So imagine getting into a car accident, but your life was good before it and you have lots of supports. That is a horrible thing. But compared to everything we've been talking about so far, it's a kind of a normal trauma. You know, the human being is already equipped to cope with it successfully. And the way they're not, there's normal supports. So they've had a normal developmental course and normal supports. That makes for normal trauma. Complex trauma is what we've been talking about. And actually, all of the things that I've been talking about can be organized in part by this notion of complex trauma. And that is beginning to be used to pull together what we're learning from each of these different types of violence on each of the different parts of the system of the developing child. And we're going to get to a more informed perspective on this.
And it sounds like it's happening in the medical profession. The next challenge is to bring that over into the teaching, social services, and public safety.
Couldn't agree more. And I don't want to overstate the progress with the medical profession. It's happening with the medical profession on highly technical medical procedures. But the medical profession also knows very well that when they're trying to help a parent or an adult patient do X or Y, their trauma history of the type we've been talking about, the complex trauma history, does affect their development. So medical professions, pediatricians, general practitioners, family practitioners especially, will benefit from, I think, the emerging science on this every bit as much as the social worker or the cop.
Dr. Aber, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, for inviting me.
Dr. Lawrence Aber is the Wilner Family Professor of Psychology and Public Policy at New York University. He was a guest of OU Tulsa yesterday speaking on Is There Normal Trauma? Historical and International Perspectives on Violence and Child Development. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.